that Yitzchak was not a little child, as you might assume, but Yitzchak was 37 years old at the time of the Akedah. This is also the proof of the well-known Medrash that Rivka was only 3 years old. Where do you get that? You get that from the same chronology, because after the Rivka was born at the time of the Akedah. That's what the Chumash suggests. So as a result, Yitzchak 37, Rivka just born. We're going to read next week that Yitzchak married Rivka when he was 40 years old. If he was 37 when she was born, she was 3 when he was 40. Now, this is not ironclad. I mean, there are different ways of interpreting the psukim. Although Rivka's birth is not recorded till after the Akedah, it doesn't have to mean that's when she was born. It could just be switching the story and saying that maybe she was 30 at the time. You know, you don't know. We're not given Rivka's age at all. But Chazal understand, based on the sequence, that Rivka was not born till the Akedah. Since Yitzchak was 37 at the time of the Akedah, as evidenced from Sarah's death, and Yitzchak married Rivka when he was 40, that the Torah records, that's where you get the precocious 3-year-old who is able to draw water for people and for camels and everything else. Now, you know, people say, how could it be? What a preposterous thing, a little girl, 3-year-old. Well, you know, go across the street, Arzabira, you know, you'll see these little kids barely in diapers, some of them almost in diapers. They go into the makolet and they buy things, you know, so... No, it's possible. Americans are spoiled. We don't start walking on our own until we're 18 or something. You know, I mean, in many, many cultures, children get involved at a much earlier stage. Okay. But there is, I do want to say, there is, however, a different view of Tosfos that puts Rivka at the age of 14. So there is a machlokas Rishonim exactly how old Rivka was. Yeah. Did you want to say? Yeah.
That seems like really fair to say that people are involved in like that type of marriage is like a very different thing than going to the Megillah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it is true, but the point basically is that obviously Rivka's having a conversation with him as well, meaning to say that even in Midos she was very, very precocious and was able to do this. Obviously that would have been the case. What do they say? Rav Aryeh Levin, who was a great, great tzaddik in Yerushalayim, he was Rebbe Yashiv's father-in-law. There's a whole book, A Tzaddik in Our Time, which is a biography of Rav Aryeh Levin. He used to visit prisoners and the like. So he once wrote a memoir. He and his wife lost a baby child at the age of 2 or 3. So he mentions what a righteous, brilliant child he had, that when he would be nursing at his mother's breast, he would make a bracha on the mother's milk and cover her breast to make the bracha. This is like, you know, 1-year-old kid, you know, he would cover it up, make a bracha, and then nurse. So there are such things that go on. Yeah?
How did Tosfos reach the age of the conclusion of 40?
He quoted a medrash. He didn't necessarily have a proof. It seems to have been an oral tradition.
So it's generally accepted that she was 3?
Well, that's the one that Rashi brings, so that's the most common understanding. Okay. Now, this idea of Sarah dying, though, the idea that Sarah's death was precipitated by the Akedah. How do we understand that? So most people understand that the Satan made her think that Yitzchak was actually killed, that she may have thought her son actually died, or what killed her is the near miss, the idea that he almost got killed. But you know, some Mefarshim learn exactly the opposite. Sarah died when she saw them coming back alive because she was so fearful that they failed the test of listening to Hashem. Very the opposite. In other words, she was upset that they didn't go through with the Akedah because she thought that would have meant they didn't have faith to obey God's promise. That's quite amazing. So she died out of the shock that how could Avraham and Yitzchak not obey the commandment of Hashem, not knowing, of course, that Hashem himself withdrew the command. Okay, where did Sarah die? So Sarah died in the city of Hebron, which Hebron is Hebron, where it is. And the alternative name of the city is Kiryat or Kiryas Arba. the city of the four. And this is based on the tradition that in Ma'aras HaMachpelah, Hebron, there are four pairs. So it's interesting because this is an example of an anachronism, apparently, because was the city called Kiryas Arba in Avram's time? Because why? Kiryas Arba means there are four pairs that are buried there. Who are the four pairs? Adam and Chava, Avraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov and Leah. Rachel is not buried with Yaakov. Rachel is buried in Beis Lechem, Kever Rachel. Nor is Yosef buried. It's interesting that the Arabs have in the mosque, you know, the Maraz HaMachpelah is a mosque today. The mosque has some grave that they assigned to Yosef. But according to our Messiah, Yosef is not buried in Maraz HaMachpelah. Yosef is buried in the Arab town of Shechem, Nablus. And there's constant, you know, there are especially Breslovers try to sneak out there to pray at Yosef's kever, but it's extremely dangerous unless you have a military escort, and every week, you know, something happens, often loss of life and the like. But Yosef's kever, according to our Messiah, is in Shechem. It's not in Maraz HaMachpelah. So the Chaira, when Avram is coming to bury Sarah, it can't be called Kiryas Arba yet, because you know, all you have is Adam and Chava. You don't have the other pairs. But that's not really a kasha, because the Torah often refers to places based on what they will be called later, even if that wasn't their name at that particular time. Okay, and don't confuse this. In modern Israel, you have Hebron, which is largely an Arab city with a very small outpost of very either courageous or crazy Jews who live in the middle of Hebron. But then you have a much more modern Jewish city, Kiryat Arba, which is adjacent to Hebron. But originally, Kiryat Arba was another name for Hebron. Okay. Now, the pasuk says, Vayavo Avram, Avram came, Lispodes Sarah, to eulogize Sarah, Velibchosa, and to cry for Sarah. So there are two stages in his grieving process. Hesped, which is eulogy, and Bechi, which is crying. The Mefarshim point out, if you look at the Gemara in Moed Katan, which gives you the halachas and the minhagim of mourning, usually it talks about crying comes before eulogy. When a person first hears about the death of a loved one, there is crying, there's the spontaneous outpouring of grief. And then you get your thoughts together to eulogize. What does this person mean to me? What did she or he teach me? What are their values? What are their legacies? But usually the idea of a hesped comes after the crying. And yet with Avraham Avinu, we see the opposite. First he eulogized, and then he cried, which is a reversal of the sequence that the Gemara normally suggests. So the Svarim say the following. Avraham's crying was not like our crying. When we lose a loved one, we are overwhelmed with personal grief. And we cry and we sob, and then we make a eulogy. With Avraham, although undoubtedly Avraham had the personal grief, but for Avraham, the primary source of the bereavement was not only what he lost, but what the world lost. The world lost the righteous woman. The world lost its spiritual center. And therefore, with Avraham, the grief was not just a personal thing. The grief came out of the eulogy. The eulogy is essentially what she represented as an ideal of holiness. And therefore, there may have been a private crying, but his grief was intensified because he realized what she was. You know, there's a Gemara in Brachos that says, when the great Amira Rav died, and Rav, the rabbi, Rav, that's why he's called Rav, was the greatest Gadol Hador, the greatest of all the Amoraim. When he died, and all of his Talmidim ripped their garment. Now normally you only rip your garment for a parent, or a sibling, you know, the people you have to mourn on. You don't rip your garment for a teacher. But when your teacher is the Gadol Hador, or your teacher is like your parent, They all ripped their garments for their teacher. Rav was their parent. And they're walking along a riverbank in Babylonia. And they stopped. They were walking for many hours. And they stopped to eat some bread by the banks of a river. And then they had a halachic shaila. Can we make a mezamen? Are we considered to be a group, or is everybody like eating their own thing? Can we be mezamen? Is this enough of a group to make a zimun or even a minyan? And somebody thought, well, we have to ask Rav the answer. We don't know the answer. Like for a split second, fraction of a second, they forgot that he just died. Just like sometimes a person wakes up in the morning after they lose a loved one. And for the first millisecond of the morning, they think their loved one is still with them. And they said, we have to ask Rav. But then they realized Rav's not around anymore. So they ripped their garment a second time. And they said, our Rebbe has left us, and we don't even know how to bench. They think about all the questions we could have asked him, all the Torah we could have learned from him, all that we could have taken advantage of that we didn't take advantage of. So the first time they ripped their garments was an emotional thing. We lost someone that we loved. We rip our garment. The second time, they realize the void in their lives and the Torah that's not here. And that's the second expression. And therefore, with Avraham, it's the same thing, that Avraham's crying was not just the spontaneous emotional feelings of losing someone that you love, but through the hesped, he internalized what is missing from the world, as it were. And that caused the second burst of crying. Right? That's what the Nitziv says. Now it says, V'yavo Avraham, so Avraham came, lispod l'sara, to eulogize Sarah, v'lib chaysa, and to cry over her. If you look at the word lib chaysa in your chumash, you will see that the chaf is a tiny chaf. It's not a normal size chaf. And that's the way it is in the Torah scroll. The Sefer Torah has a tiny chaf. Now, in the Torah, you know, there are big letters sometimes and little letters. Right, certain things. For example, Shema Yisrael is maybe the most famous example. Shema Yisrael, so the ayin of Shema is a big ayin. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, the Dalet of Echad is a big Dalet. And that spells ayin Dalet, aid, witness. When you say the Shema, you're giving testimony that there's one God. So sometimes we have a reason for big letters and small letters, and sometimes we don't. It is a halacha l'Moshe miSinai. It is a din that Hashem said to Moshe that you have to write the Torah this way, but we don't always have a reason. So why is there a small chaf? Do we have a reason for a small chaf? So the Baal HaTurim gives a reason that's a little bit of a dochak reason. He says, well, the reason why there's a small chaf is because Avraham's crying was not extreme, meaning he didn't cry a lot. He only cried a little. Because she was a zakena, because she was old, she was old. Everyone has to go sometime. She lived a good life at 127. So he did not mourn because in many ways her life was like a celebration. You know, someone lives a good life, in a sense. It's a good thing. They go back to God. They go back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know, the Medrash in Kehelas says, it gives an interesting mashal about how to view death. It says that everybody rejoices when a baby is born into the world. A new baby, everybody's happy. And when people die, everybody's sad. But the Medrash suggests maybe it ought to be the opposite. Because when a baby is born, who knows what that person will be? Righteous? Evil? Will they live up to their potential? Will they not live up to their potential? There ought to be kind of trepidation. But when a person leaves the world and lived a life of Kedusha, a life of righteousness, of course we're sad because we don't have them, but there's kind of a joy that they completed their mission in life and are ready to go home back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Baal HaTurim says that Avraham did not grieve that much because Sarah was old and filled with her days and filled with Masim Tovim. So she has a chelik in Olam Haba. But I want to share with you a very, very ingenious halachic vort that explains why there's a small chav. Now this is a little complicated, but you'll pick up some interesting knowledge of a certain area. When did the Akedas Yitzchak take place? So the standard tradition in Chazal is that the Akedah was on Rosh Hashanah. Akedas Yitzchak was on Rosh Hashanah itself, and that is why we mention in the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, may Hashem remember the merit of the Akedas Yitzchak. It happened on the first of Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah. However, there is a minority viewpoint that says the Akedah happened on Yom Kippur. Now, going with the Yom Kippur, we can figure out when Sarah died. Because like this, from the Akedah to where Avram was living is a trip of 3 days. Remember it says they walked 3 days, right? So it's a 3-day trip. If Yitzchak was sacrificed on the 10th of Tishrei, which is Yom Kippur, or he would have been sacrificed on the 10th of Tishrei, so they had to travel back 3 full days till they discovered that Sarah died. So they traveled, the 3 full days would be the 11th. Now there's part of the 10th, but they had 3 full days. So it's the 11th, the 12th, those are 2 full days. And then part of the 10th, where they started traveling, and part of the 14th would make up 3 days. In other words, 36 hours of traveling. Okay? Well, it's not 36 hours of traveling, you probably rested, but you have to have the equivalent of 3 full days. So you have, let's say, half of 10th of Tishrei, the 11th, the 12th, and the first half of the 14th of Tishrei. So, when they came home, they discovered that Sarah died. So when did Sarah die? Sarah died Erev Sukkos. The 14th of Tishrei is Erev Sukkos. Now, did you have, yeah?
What about the 13th?
I'm sorry. 1 second. Am I right over here? They travel the 11th. I'm sorry. You're right. So apparently we're not counting the 10th. The 11th, the 12th, right, okay. So half of the 10th, yeah, you're right. Half of the 10th, the 11th, the 12th, and the 13th. Yeah, so this cheshvan must be learning 3 full days. In other words, it was a 3.5-day trip, meaning they left on half of the 10th, so they're 3 full days. Are 11, 12, 13. They come to Hebron on the 14th, and then based on the first medrash I told you, when Sarah sees them coming back, that's when she dies. So Sarah died on the 14th of Tishrei. Now, let's talk about the halacha a little bit. So Sarah was buried on that same day. Sarah was buried on the 14th of Tishrei. What is the halacha if chas v'shalom someone is buried on Erev Yom Tov? So it's a very strange set of halachas. The normal mourning is one sit shiva, and then there's a more lenient mourning for 30 days, meaning another 23 days, 7 and 23, right? The first 7 days are called shiva, and then the rest is called shloshim, which is only 23 days, and that's more lenient. But what is the halacha about Yom Tov? The halacha is that if a person began sitting Shiva, even 1 minute before Yom Tov cancels out the obligations of sitting Shiva, and the 1 minute before Yom Tov counts like 7 days towards the Shloshim, meaning Shiva is canceled, and that 1 second day or 1 minute is treated as 7 days. So that means the following. If a levaya takes place on Erev Sukkos, this is how it works. The mourners sit Shiva till the Yom Tov begins, or till an hour before the Yom Tov. And Shiva is finished. There is no more Shiva than that. But that is treated as 7 days towards the Shloshim. The 7 days of Sukkos are treated as another 7 days towards the Shloshim. Shemini Atzeres, which is only one day, but because it is a holiday, it's treated like 7 days. So, how many days after, let's just talk about Israel just to keep it simple. If someone was buried Erev Sukkot, how many days after Sukkot do they have to keep the restrictions of Shaloshim? 9 days. You see, because Erev Sukkot, that 1 hour, counts like 7. Sukkot counts for 7. And Shemini Atzeres counts for 7. 7, 7, 7, 21 days. You need 9 more days for Shloshim. So, now this is very different. If, God forbid, the burial is on Yom Tov proper, then nothing gets canceled, and they got to do all of a Shiva after Yom Tov. But if the burial was even 1 minute before Yom Tov, Shiva gets canceled, and the Erev Yom Tov 1 hour counts for 7 days toward Shloshim. So it turns out that Avram's mourning for Sarah was actually only, let's see, 7, 7, 9, that's 14 and 9 is 23 days, 24 days. In other words, Erev Sukkot, for a little bit of time, is 1 day, part of 1 day. Sukkot is 7 days. Shemini Atzeres is Lamaisa 1 day. Now, this physically, how many days do they keep mourning? 1, 7, 1, that's 9 days, and the other 9 is 18, meaning they fulfill their shloshim in 18 days. Let me just say it one more time. Meaning the actual tekufa of their mourning is only 18 days, but halacha computes it as if it's 30 days. How is that so? The first day of Erev Sukkot counts as 7. 7 days of Sukkot are 7. That's the only normal count. And Shemini Atzeres as a chag counts as 7. So 7, 7, 7 is 21 days. Then another 9 after makes it 30. So their 30 days were actually kept within a span of only 18 days.
Doesn't the minute of Shiva count as 7 days also?
Does the what of Shiva?
The minute.
Yes, that's how you get 21 days, because the Erev Sukkot was seven. The beginning, that's 7.
And the first day of Sukkot is 7.
No. Once you get into Sukkot, the 7 days of Sukkot are 7. Meaning, it's only Erev Sukkot that counts as 7. The 7 days of Sukkot are 7. Shemini Atzeres counts as 7. You see? So that's how you get 21. Then you have 9 afterwards. So that's 30. But in terms of physical days, Erev Sukkot is 1, Sukkot is 7, Shemini Atzeres is 1, that's 9. All you have is 18 days. Now, of those 18 days, they really didn't keep that much mourning, because on Yom Tov you don't mourn anyway. So of those 18 days, the only days they really mourned was Erev Sukkot and the 9 days afterwards. So from 30, they kept their shloshim in 18 days, and of those 18 days, they only observed mourning laws for 10 of them. In other words, they fulfilled the shloshim with only 10 days of real mourning. 30 minus 10 is 20. In Lipkosa, the chaf is small, because 20 days were diminished from the Shloshim period. Okay, so it's a complicated board, but that's the idea. Meaning, actually, they did keep 18 days of Shloshim, but of those 18 days, the 8 days that were Yom Tov, you really don't mourn. So of the 18 that they kept, there was only 10 days of real mourning, Erev Sukkot, part of that day, and the 9 days afterwards. Therefore, it's only 10 out of 30. They lost 20 days. Libkosa, small chaf, diminish the 20. Now, again, there are a lot of problems with this. This is assuming that Avram had the laws of Shiva and Shloshim and the like, and all of that came later. Shiva and Shloshim is not even a Torah law, it's only a rabbinic law. And yet, we do have a Messiah in Chazal that the Avos did keep the whole Torah, even before it was given. And they kept even rabbinic laws that were known to them through divine inspiration. So this type of approach, you know, is at least a possible approach. But again, just for your own halakhic knowledge, be sure that you know the difference between a levaya that takes place on Erev Chag. In fact, let's take it for Pesach, just to show you the difference, because it's a little different. Pesach and Sukkos are a little different. And the reason is, Sukkos has two holidays, Sukkos and Shemini Atzeres. Pesach only is one holiday called Pesach. Even though the last day of Pesach is a Chag, but it's not a new Chag. So let's compare Pesach and Sukkos for a moment. If a Levaya takes place Erev Sukkos, so the Shiva is canceled when the Yom Tov begins, so Erev Chag counts for seven, the 7 days of Sukkos counts for seven, Shemini Atzeres as a new Yom Tov counts for seven. That's how you get 21 days. You got to keep 9 days afterwards. With Erev Pesach, it's going to be different. Erev Pesach, the Yom Tov will cancel Shiva. So Erev Pesach counts for seven. Pesach counts for seven, 14. But since there's no new Chag, so you have to keep Shloshim for 16 days, right? So after Sukkos, you keep Shloshim for 9 days. After Pesach, you keep Shloshim for 16 days because you only get the benefit of the 7 days of Erev Yom Tov and then the 7 days of Pesach.
So if something came out Erev Shavuos, is it 2 days? Is it 1 day or is it 7 days?
Okay. So we treat Shavuos Erev Shavuos is seven, that's for sure. No, that's always true. That's always true. For every Chag. Shavuos, if it's a machlokes, I have to check the halacha. It's a machlokes in the Gemara. Do I treat Shavuos as 1 day, or do I treat it like Shemini Atzeres and make it 7 days? In other words, how many days of Shloshim after? But you certainly, the one thing for sure is, you certainly get 7 days in your Erev Yom. Now, let me just point out, I'll check about it, because there's a machlokes in the Gemara. I don't remember how we paskin on Shavuos. I believe we count it as 7 days. So, therefore, Erev Shavuos is 7, Shavuos is 7, which is 14. So it's just like Pesach, therefore you get 16 days of Shloshim afterwards. But let me point out that if a Levaya is during Chol HaMoed, not before Chol HaMoed, then nothing is canceled and a person has to sit a full Shiva right after the Chag. In other words, he doesn't have that 1 hour thing because it's only if Shiva started that it gets canceled. But if the Kfur was on Chol HaMoed, you didn't start a Shiva, so you have to do it after the Yom Tov. However, interestingly enough, the days of Yom Tov still count towards Shloshim on a one-to-one basis. So in effect, you've had part of your Shloshim before you said Shiva, which is an unusual sequencing. Yeah.
Why isn't that on Shemini Atzeres it counts for seven?
Yeah. The concept is this. So here's the concept. And this is really the answer to Shavuos as well. Whatever the definition of a Chag equals 7 days. So if it's that's what it is. Chag equals seven. If the Chag is 7 days, then you need 7 days to equal seven. If the Chag is 1 day, then 1 day equals seven. So Sukkos is a Chag, and Shemini Atzeres is a Chag. But since Sukkos is a 7 day Chag, so you got to have 7 days to be seven. Since Shemini Atzeres is a 1 day Chag, then only 1 day is enough to be seven. That's why Shavuos would also be seven. You see the logic here? Meaning you are correct that means in effect, well, why is 1 day of Shemini Atzeres equal to 7 days of Sukkos? But the short answer is because both of those holidays are given the name Chag. And therefore, the 7 days of Sukkos is a Chag of 7 days, and the 1 day of Shemini Atzeres is a Chag of 7 days, because whatever is called Chag is given the status of 7 days.
So if one were to lose a relative in Chol HaMoed Sukkos,
he would get seven and not 7 years?
That's a machlokas. Again, it's complicated. That is a machlokas achronim. Some achronim say that we give Shmini Atzeres the status of seven only for levaya that was before Yom Tov. But a levaya during Chol HaMoed, Shmini Atzeres only counts for one. So that is a big machlokas. In other words, does it count? Does Shmini Atzeres count for 7 days towards a shloshim when the levaya took place on Chol HaMoed? That's your question.
Why wouldn't it? It's a separate cut.
Well, I understand, but these mourning laws are rabbinic, and it could be that the Rabbanan only wanted to do this when there at least was the beginning of a proper Shiva, then they gave you this leniency. In other words, the beginning, Erev Yom Tov, there was a bit of a Shiva. But Chol HaMoed, where you didn't begin Shiva at all, they didn't want to give you that leniency. But you're correct. In a way, consistency, if you'd be fully consistent, you're 100% correct. It ought to be the same. It ought to be the same, but it is a machloket. Okay, all right, anyway, we'll stop here, and I think Rabbi Wasserman is coming. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a good day.